Hello and welcome to the Weird Things Podcast. I'm Andrew Mean, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello, hello.
And thank goodness Brian had the foresight to have his children many, many, many years ago, so he could be here for this podcast today.
Yes. There's a phantom Justin Robert Young floating around who will manifest himself at some point during the program.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see.
Yeah, that's another I've dealt with fathers before.
Yeah, apparently kids, they need a lot of time.
Little chaos engines, man, upending all your plans, tearing everything asunder.
Yeah, but big congrats to Justin and Ashley on the birth of their baby. Really, we couldn't be happier.
We're not at all putting the value of this program over that.
Child. We're all very excited. That's one of those, having known this kid since he was 15, and being very happy that, you know, it wasn't a year later they decided to have his first kid.
like another full Florida man might.
Oh yeah. Oh, I have a buddy who I went to high school with who, his parents were very, very strict, did not think that he was studying hard enough, and they wanted to teach him a lesson. So they sent him off to some military academy in Georgia, promptly meets up with a local girl, gets her pregnant. You know?
they just weaponized his miscreant status.
But ended up having two beautiful, wonderful kids with, or I don't think that relationship worked out, but the two kids he's got, they're great, and it's fun because, like, you know, when I see my buddy, like, he's got these kids that are like fully grown functioning adults and stuff.
He's already an empty nester.
Yeah, he's young, still kind of a young guy. And I'm like, man, like, this is really kind of great because, you actually think he figured life out very well. So, you know, well-adjusted kids and, you know, so anyhow, who knows? So some interesting space news this week. We know the return path now for the astronauts on board the International Space Station who were taken there by the Boeing Starliner.
Yeah.
And it will not be on a Starliner.
I guess that SpaceX craft is set to head up fairly soon, right? And then they're just going to hitch a ride after that mission ends and it heads back?
They come back like in February.
So right. But I mean, yeah, like the craft goes up. Some reason I had in my silly head that they would go up just to retrieve them and come down, which is nonsense. Obviously, they would wait for the existing mission and then just two people got bumped. And then, you know, more people, it'd be a little crowded in the ISS for a bit. And then they'll catch a ride on the way back.
Yeah. Yeah. They can just, because these things, they can hold up to like or seven people or something, so they've got a pretty good capacity. So that's good news. They're gonna bring back the Starliner, I think, on September 6th. So, you know, best case scenario, it comes back intact. They'll be able to take it apart and understand what went wrong or what the systems are. You know, a worst case scenario is it burns up in the atmosphere and we don't get that data, because we do want to have multiple systems to get access to space.
Yeah, and that is the bummer about the that is one of the many bummers about the malfunctions on this is we love competition. I didn't realize it feels like Boeing was so far behind SpaceX, but when you look at the total long-term trajectory when they awarded the two contracts, Starliner was only 2 years behind SpaceX for sending crews up to space. I believe I could double check that timeline.
Well, like for functional, let's take a look there. I think for the actual first crew Dragon, let's
to the ISS, I guess it'd be.
Yeah.
I hope the
first crewed flight of a Dragon out to the ISS was May 30th, 2020.
Okay. So four years behind. Okay.
Yeah.
That's behind. Significant. Let me see when the contract was, because I remember it was you, Andrew, that came up with the comparison of like why the commercial spaceflight program was such a good idea, because it's like you mentioned specifically, it's not like the post office builds their own cars. They buy cars and use them to deliver the mail. And likewise, you know, NASA should be focused on the science, not building rockets.
Yeah, there's certainly a role to be done for doing some kind of interesting areas of exploration that, that the private sector maybe isn't wanting to do. But, you know, it stands to reason that when you've got people willing to spend the money to make the thing work, you know, Bezos and Musk, et cetera, that let them throw a ton of money at the problem and then, you know, let them compete. And we had also this week is we had a first failure of a first stage
on the return.
So the and this was its 22nd flight. So they had the Falcon, you know, first stage on the 22nd flight. This thing was coming back down, did a hard landing and kind of went kablooey. So right now they're evaluating that. And I think there might be a hold on any Falcon 9 launches for a while for that, but probably not very long because this is the part of the mission that's the least important.
Is the gravy.
But you still want to know what happened. Yeah.
Don't panic. VU in the chat is asking, you know, aren't they currently grounded? Yeah, I think they get grounded every time something explodes and all it takes to get clearance is like, figure out what went wrong. Let us know that you're working on it and you can fly again.
Yeah. So, you know, fact that it was mission 22, which was 21 more missions than people thought was possible. And even originally, SpaceX was thinking maybe they'd get 10 out of them.
Wait, what do you think? Do you have a thumbnail sketch of how much money they saved by reusing that one 21 more times?
You know, one of the things that's really hard about kind of calculating that is that there is a tremendous amount of research in whatever they spent into developing the thing. And so then if you ask yourself, okay,
thinking of that initial investment as a sunk cost, how much gravy have they made as a result of just one vessel before it went kablooey on the pad, on their investment?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, yeah, I can't imagine what do they cost to refit it, whatever. You would imagine it tens of millions of dollars, you know, to hundreds of millions of dollars, probably.
Yeah, I think it would be wildly conservative to say $10 million to reuse it. There's no way you could do a first stage for $10 million, is there? So it's got to be higher than that.
Yeah, the original cost per launch was like $90 million for the full vehicle. So you imagine your first stage might be like $30 or $40 million of that.
So let's go on the low end and say 30, right?
Yeah, I could say the half. Yeah, I'm hesitant to just sort of guess because I think it's clearly very effective because you know they've been they had 267 successful landings. This was the booster's 23rd launch. Sorry. Fake news for me. It was not the 22nd, 23rd launch. So kind of insane.
Yeah, it is.
So space, everybody, open for business. And who knows what's next? We're getting two things coming up. Is it going to be the Polaris Dawn mission? That's the one that Jared Isaacman's funding, where he's going to be doing a spacewalk and testing out for the first time the SpaceX spacesuit in an EVA. So they're going to take a Crew Dragon to the highest point, the largest, you know, the furthest distance humans have ever been since we went to the moon. And then he's going to open up the door and hop outside and wave.
and that's that?
Well, it's going to be a very interesting test of a lot of systems. Because if you think about, you know, if our goal is towards building bigger things in space, doing more stuff in space, we've got a lot of data on, you know, from the ISS, but that's certainly how NASA does it, NASA's way of doing things. And one of the things we don't really talk about is how expensive it is every time we do that. And from a practicality point of view, part of the problem we've talked about before is that I'll give you an example. I don't know if I spoke about this here, but there was a story about the first, did I tell you about the first venture they put on the space shuttle?
No, did you say first printer?
Yeah, the first computer printer.
Oh, no.
So let me pull up the data on that one, because it's kind of a... So on the space shuttle, they realized they needed to have a printer. They wanted to have a printer that was going to go on board it. So the first launch in 1981, what they did is they basically took an Army teleprinter, like, you know, some sort of teleprinter system they would use, like, for, you know, secured communications, whatever. And guess how much this thing weighed, Brian?
Oh, God. This is what year?
1981.
I know 1983, we had an Epson dot matrix that was about yay big. But to be an industrial kind of printer, I mean, at most, I could picture it being 40, 50 pounds.
This thing was about 70 pounds, right?
60, 70 pounds. And this is back when it was $10,000 per pound to get to orbit.
Back when it was 20K to orbit.
20,000. And is that, and that's not even adjusted for inflation yet?
No. So,
whoa.
So I ran the math on this to what it cost to be able to do this. So the plan was, it was called a interim. It was just going to be this sitter. So it was 59 pounds. It was $27,000 per pound to orbit it, right? $27,000 per pound, right? It cost $1.6 million. Now, this was just a short gap printer. This was a temporary printer until they built something that was better to use. It cost $1.6 million every space shuttle mission to send this printer into space.
And those are still not adjusted for inflation.
No. Okay. Now, good thing is, Brian, we only sent it out 50 times.
Wait, what? Oh, because they were printing, there was no space station, so they had to lug it with them every time.
Well, again, but the point is the space shuttle. The idea is it's just on the space shuttle mission. This is before the space station was built. The point was they never bothered to make a smaller printer for a decade.
Wow.
And because, hey, it's government. And so we spent $80 million lugging this thing into space, which is the cost of a Falcon 9 mission, by the way, an entire mission. You can buy an entire space mission for $80 million. Do you think that we could have shaved a pound or 2 pounds or 3 pounds off of this printer? Absolutely. With, you know, one engineer and a week's worth of time, we would have saved millions of dollars. And this is a thing that just drives me up the wall. I want to get political here, but we talk about raising taxes and stuff like that. This is a thing that happens 1,000 times over and over in government, because there are really brilliant people there that be capable of doing it, but somebody else said, no, it's not our priority. And you think about military spending and all that, you know, people like, you can cut spending and have even better stuff if you're really efficient about how you spent it. So,
well, and of course, it's just a matter of incentives. Like, what are the incentives to get around to doing that? It's like, well, we know for sure it'll work, and you're just introducing risk to an already risky environment. I think the safest thing is to do the thing that we know works until it doesn't.
Yeah, and meanwhile, it's, you could assign an engineering team for 3 weeks to do it and reduce the cost by half and save us $40 million. Literally, that could have been done. Like, it would have been a very easy thing to have done and saved $40 million. It could have gone to some space probe or something else like that. But it is incentives. And the thing is that the further away the person is who's writing the checks from the people who spend it, the more, you know, irresponsible the spending gets.
Yeah. Well, I guess do we have other space news, or should we transition into some more other stuff? Because if we're going to transition, I'm going to remind everyone that they should head on over to patreon.com/weirdthings. Keep us being weird every single week. Get exclusive access to our After Things segment, where we talk about life as being independent creators and artists, talking about startups, success, that kind of stuff. That's Patreon, patreon.com/weirdthings.
Sounds good. Brian, let me pull up my list of topics unless you have something you want to dive into.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, this is, I like the menu approach. Get to walk up and go to the Weird Things counter. A couple of goblins up front. They're all like, welcome to Weird Things. Can I take your order? Then I get to keep the line held up as I go, let's see, we got a no Sasquatch news. That's stale. I had AI for breakfast. I just had some space. Well, let's see.
Do you want to, I got a space thing, but it's
no. Yeah. We can go back to space. I could always have more space.
So you remember the WoW signal?
Yes, this is, for those who don't know, this is, it was Drake, right? The creator of the Drake equation. He started pointing, I think it was either the Very Large Array or some large radio telescope to just random stars. And incredibly, he happened upon something that had regular pulses that seemed to mimic what he would expect to see an alien signal saying howdy. And so he drew a circle around it and wrote the word wow exclamation point next to it.
I don't know if Drake was involved in all, but yeah, everything else. Yes. The astronomer by the name of Jerry Amon with the Ohio State University radio telescope. So this is 1977. And basically, but yeah, exactly what you said about they had basically a radio telescope though, and they were looking for, you know, signals that looked like they would have to have been, that would not have appeared by any natural means of which they know. And so, like you said, he saw the signal, drew a circle around it, wrote the word wow. And what's now, you know, much, you know, here we are almost 50 years later, and people are starting to look at like, hey, you know, can we, because it was the right radio frequency, the right band, whatever. And now some killjoys have come along and said, we don't think it's aliens. and everybody kind of thought it was a fluke. Everybody kind of thought it was probably like, you know, there's something, we just, it's one of the beautiful things about space. Well, it's so big.
Because space is so big, it always smelled funny to me that, so let me get this straight. We go hundreds of thousands of years without searching for aliens. And then like a week after we just start looking for aliens, just pointing at random stars, and we find maybe, but think about it. Yeah. Maybe in that moment they were thinking, well, they must be everywhere.
Yeah. So what the theory suggested here by astrobiologist Abel Mendez is, and his co-authors, what they think happened is that there is a magnetar, which is a highly magnetic neutron star, was passing behind a cloud of atomic hydrogen and could have flared up with enough energy to basically create a microwave razor, a microwave laser, a maser. So basically, giant maser in space aimed right at Earth, which makes you feel better now, Brian.
Well, there are, and again, you know, space is pretty big. We've talked about gravitational lensing here before, right?
Sure, all the time.
Okay, so gravitational lensing is when, let's say there's a supermassive star that has a big enough gravity well that, you know, light will bend around that gravity well. And so Einstein predicted that, well, if that's the case, then maybe there's a super bright star directly behind a very heavy star. And then and the gravitational lensing will cause us to see multiple versions of the exact same star, you know, kind of like, you know, if you hold up a wine glass to a light, you'll see multiple copies of the light. Just that with gravity bending the waves around a supermassive star. And so he predicted it, and then he went to heaven, and then we found one because we looked long enough. So the idea of now. You could say, oh, it just happens to be lined up perfect at Earth. But it's like, yeah, there's statistically speaking, a lot of things aimed a lot of places, including us, will be in the way of one of them.
We may have talked about this before. You ever been to Griffith Observatory in LA?
I've driven past it. I've always wanted to go. But do they still have star parties?
I'm sure they do. It is worth visiting because there's the observatory and they built underneath a huge museum. And so you see the observatory, then you go below it, and they have on a wall that's like a 3 or 4 story wall that stretches for like 100 or so feet, is a giant map of stars and solar system, stars and even galaxies, right? You see this huge, it's a photograph of all of this, right? And you look at this, you go, man, the universe is just huge. And then you walk over to a point and they show you a little square about, you know, an inch or so across. And they say, yeah, this is just this much of the night sky.
God, that's so incredible.
And it's lost on most. I've probably been there two or three times before I realized that, before I even realized, oh no, this is just, you know, this is how much of like your arm length at an inch away from, you know, at an arm's length from your, you know, head. This is how much of an inch of the sky takes up.
So I must confess that I don't know what is a maser just a laser, but with microwave energy instead of light?
Exactly. Instead of visible light, it emits microwave energy.
And is microwave is lower on the frequency spectrum or higher? I think it's lower, isn't it?
No, I believe it's higher.
Okay. So, which is why a Faraday cage will contain it.
Yeah. So let's go look at our graph here.
Because I know the lower the frequency, the more signals tend to be able to penetrate.
Yeah. So let's go ahead and pull up the image here so we can describe it. So if we were looking at a spectrum. If you take, you have at the low rate, you have got some Y rays, wonderful Y rays. Then you've got X rays. Then you got UV. Then you got the tiny area of the visible spectrum. Then to the right of that is infrared. And then to the right of that's microwave. And then above microwave, you get FM radio and then GAP and then AM radio, then long radio waves. So of it above infrared.
It should be below infrared. I think you're reading it backwards because infrared is a lower wavelength, and then radios are still lower still. And then
I'm giving you the diagram exactly as it is, Brian.
Okay. But do they here? Let me see. Light spectrum.
Yeah.
I'll see if I can find a picture. Okay, here we go. Yeah, this is boy, it's fun to revisit physics. There we go. Yeah, there we go. So microwave seems to be a lower wavelength, and then you get higher and higher, and you get ultraviolet, and then X-ray.
It's expensive structure when I go.
What's that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So like radio does penetrate Earth's atmosphere. Microwaves do not, and then we get to visible light does. And then we get to know for, it says ultraviolet, but I guess that means we reflect a lot of it or keep a lot of it out. Do you ever get worried about a star going supernova and just vaporizing the Earth?
Ryan, it's one of the main things that keeps me up at night.
That and taxes.
Yeah. Yep.
Did you happen on any details of what causes it to be a maser?
Well, yeah, it was the idea that you have this highly energetic magnetic field that hits like a bunch of hydrogen, and so a hydrogen cloud, and so atomic hydrogen. So basically, it's like you think about what creates a laser. So you take a gas, you apply a ton of energy to it, and then it starts to emit radiation at a certain frequency. So that is a theory. Was it basically, you know, it was happened to be a naturally occurring maser.
God, that's so cool. I don't even have any response to that, unfortunately.
Yeah, yeah.
Outside of that's cool.
So space is weird. I'm sorry, just dealing with a couple things here. Let's see here. This was another interesting story that I saw, which is kind of cool. One thing that's fascinating about nature is that nature doesn't care as long as something works. And a study, this is one thing I'm going to say, oh, you're going to cool. I'm like, well, yeah, of course, I guess it would do that. One of the ways butterflies can accumulate pollen is that basically build up static in their wings. And as they fly by a flower, the pollen just goes cling and they don't even have to land on it.
That's awesome. That's similar to the kid experiment of taking styrofoam pellets. You know, you tear up some styrofoam and then you charge a comb and run over it and it leaps right up onto the comb.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it just seems that somewhere along the evolutionary history, you know, it turns out that that was just a perfectly fine way to basically accumulate this. You know, it's a very sophisticated way in one regard. And it might actually explain, you know, something of why their wings are like they are, or moss or things like that. It might have been not, might be why they're not so nice and fuzzy, that maybe they're just designed to attract static electricity.
Did you see this story about the NASA discovery about, of course, the hyperbolic headline says NASA makes discovery, quote, as important as gravity about Earth and possibly life on other planets. Did you happen to see this one?
No, I didn't.
Basically, it says here, NASA scientists have discovered an electric field encompassing Earth's atmosphere that is, quote, fundamental as gravity, could even give clues about life on other planets. A team of NASA scientists detected the ambipolar electric field for the first time with a suborbital rocket 150 miles above Earth's atmosphere. The ambipolar electric field is a weak planet-wide electric field that's fundamental, and they repeat themselves. It has been theorized for 60 years, but this is the first time they have data to back it up. I'm not entirely sure what they're going to do with it, but it's awesome to still see empirical validations of, you know, 60-year-old theories happening.
And there's a lot of interesting systems that go into play. Like, one of my favorite things doing is like looking at the screensaver for, on my Apple TV when they show the Earth, because you'll see the atmosphere, then you'll see this yellow, looks like almost like a yellow line going around. And have you ever seen this before?
I have not.
All right, let me see if I can find a photo. You'll see this from Photos ISS, Photos of Earth, Photos.
This is like a computer generated line or?
No. This is like a legit thing. So if you type in Photos of Earth, ISS, and you'll see they talk about the atmosphere glowing gold.
Okay. Oh,
wow,
yeah.
Look who joined us here.
Look what the cat dug in. Hold on. Let me reformat all these screens. Hello, Justin Robert Young.
Hello, everybody. How are we?
Good.
Awesome.
Good. Are you able to turn up your mic a little bit?
Sure. That's it.
So
that's as much as I can.
We're looking at.
Perfect.
In some of the photos you'll see of the International Space Station, looking at the Earth and kind of edge on at the atmosphere, when the sun is at the right angle or like behind whatever, you'll see this yellow line going around it. And you can see it right there, Brian, in right above the Earth. That's actually sodium ions.
Oh, which makes sense because like sodium arc lamps glow gold like that.
Yeah, so we're lighting up our immediate vicinity like a crappy neighborhood.
Oh, wait, so we're causing that?
Well, that's like the energy, the solar energy, basically charging the sodium ions to glow.
Oh, okay. When you said we I thought
we need to cut our sodium like most men in their 40s.
Exactly.
But I thought that was a cool effect because I remember looking at that line on scene of like the Apple TV or whatever. I'm like, oh, that's, what is that? And then Googling it and like, oh, wow, that's really cool.
Hey, Justin, talking about weird things, do you want to give a brief summary of for those who only listen to this program, about how you enjoyed seeing the weirdness that was the miracle of human life?
Yeah, we had a baby.
Okay.
You know? It happens. Sometimes you have a baby, you know, a baby came out, cried. We had our first meeting with the pediatrician and she said everything's on the up and up. So we're rocking and rolling here at the old young house.
Oh, do we lose Andrew?
I don't know. No one does. What would you guys go over before I got here?
We talked about the SpaceX going to take the Boeing people back home. We talked about the grounding temporarily of SpaceX due to the first the 23rd flight of a stage one resulting in a rapid decompression, unscheduled decomposition or whatever. Gotcha. Gotcha. And we were talking about space masers blasting Earth with microwave lasers. And I think you're all caught up.
There we go. There we go. We're back. We're back on track.
I have a lot of construction projects going on around the house. So,
oh, so did you just get dropped?
You want to know what, Maine? Same. There's been a lot of construction.
You got one little 8-pound construction project.
I'll tell you what, for 5 pounds, 9 ounces, it is certainly a loud one at times.
How's your sleep been?
You want to know what? The sleep, fingers crossed, has not been terrible in that I really kind of feel like this process I've been prepared for with varying different jobs. The idea of being a parent that is trying to help with everything that's going on with my wife and the baby reminds me a lot of being a server. There's just kind of it's always, you know, the rush. And so I'm trying to do side work. I'm trying to get, you know, there's expectations for people. I got to have a smile on my face. And then everything that happens throughout the night just reminds me a lot of business travel. And you have to wake up at some ungodly hour and get your stuff together and get to the airport. And so lately, for the last 3 days, it's basically been, I have to get to the airport every day, but it happens anywhere between 1 o'clock and 3 o'clock. And I don't have to leave the house. I just have to bottle feed a baby. That's the trip to the airport. And then I get to go back to sleep. And I have to wake up about 2.5 hours later. But that only happens twice. The only big thing that has really hit me out of nowhere was at one point, I took a nap yesterday because my wife was sleeping and the baby was sleeping. And so I laid down next to her and I woke up and I felt like I got hit by a car. I have never woken up from a nap where I felt like that disoriented in my life. Cause I guess I just woke up at the wrong time in whatever sleep rhythm my body was like expecting to get actual nourishing sleep. And then I woke up and they were like, whoa, what's going on?
Yeah. That kind of like hard reset. Can be a little bit jarring. Well, that's exciting.
Yeah. So far so good.
You know, as rough as it can be, at least you weren't a sea cow 20 million years ago who got eaten by both a crocodile and a shark.
Go on.
This is from Science Alert. Apparently, they found the remains of a sea cow that was first, they think it was dragged by a crocodile before its body was later chewed on by a shark. But it was a basically sort of in the early to middle Miocene epoch, which kind of rough times, apparently, especially if you're that much giant, delicious red meat. Mm. But they looked at the fossils, they did a reconstruction of it, and they're looking at the different bite marks of it. And it's like, well, that looks like crocodile. We can see the teeth and dentures from there. And then they're like, that looks like an extinct tiger shark.
Wow. And
probably is scavenging for that. So that's quite a traumatic end.
That is worse than my life.
I am glad I'm not a sea cow from the whatever era.
For reasons beyond maybe we all know, I got very interested in studying the history of shark bites, etc. Mm-hmm. And there have been a few different examples of that. They found the oldest known, there's been a couple examples of what they think might be the oldest known shark attack victims. Around 3,000 years ago, a man was fishing the waters of Sato Island in the Japanese archipelago when he was attacked by a large shark. Despite being recovered, he suffered serious and extensive injuries, and he had at least 790 deep serrated wounds. And apparently they did recover him, but they were able to, you know, bury him in a community cemetery along with, you know, a bunch of shells around there to, you know, remind his ghost of, you know, where this thing happened. You know, that first they found this body and they're like, there was just really, really chewed up and like, how did another human do this to it? Docker wasn't. It was a shark. Oh. You know, this was a shark victim. There was another example of a body found of a boy who in Peru, and this thing, this they believe this skeleton was 6,000 years old. And so he is basically, that is, they think, is the oldest example of a person being bitten by a shark. Obviously, we've been bitten by sharks well into our monkey days and we've veered into the water. But as far as being able to find any bones of this.
Are there
that's a deep history for sharks, man. That's a legacy. Yeah. That's something to be proud of.
Yeah.
If I were a shark, which I'm not.
Yeah, for sure.
So
yeah.
I think it's a horrifying. It's a black mark on the shark community, the kind of violence they unleashed on our people.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, the thing that I was happy about with like doing Shark Week was that it's done a lot to bring up awareness of how valuable sharks are to our ecosystem. And mm-hmm. that was one of the things that Peter Benchley had regretted, was that it kind of created this fear of great whites and a fear of sharks. And then I think that we've all kind of, people have much more grown to have a respect and an admiration for them in their own lane.
In their own lane. Yeah. I mean, you don't want a shark wandering up on you. Right, thinking you're some kind of snack. They confuse you. Next thing you know, you don't have an arm anymore, or you're that poor sap that got eaten so many years ago.
Yeah, that's
is there any ape that likes being in the water or swimming besides humans?
So, there was the hypothesis about Lucy. That one of the things when they found, remember Lucy, the one of the oldest, proto-humans, is that they found a lot of shells and stuff around her. And it looked like that she may have foraged for shells and eaten things like, shellfish, et cetera, because that point in that period of time in Africa, it was extremely marshy. So we know that, and that was where the aquatic ape theory came from, that we may have spent part of our developmental history in the water, which doesn't seem to be likely. But we do know snow monkeys love the water. We've seen other mm-hmm. apes, snow monkeys will just hop into an onset there, and other monkeys can swim. There, the problem is for the body density and having particularly not a lot of fat in the right spots, swimming's not necessarily pleasant for most primates. But the aquatic ape theory, remember that one?
I don't actually.
So it's a fun theory. It's really not supported by a lot of evidence. It's a lot of just say so stuff, but I do love it as a theory, because if you were to look at the human being and you're to look at every other ape, what's the first thing you noticed? Our hair.
Yes.
Right. Our apparent lack of hair. We actually have like the same number of hair follicles, apparently, but
But again, we don't see a lot of hairy creatures under the sea.
Yeah, or if you do, it's for preserving, it's like a tight mat, it's for preserving that. But you can go one direction, like otters and whatnot, or seals, and have a very fine fur, or excuse me, otters, and some other water creatures. Or you go the direction of like dolphins and porpoises and whatnot, and you're very smooth. Now, the way our skin and the way our hair works is probably more likely having from evolved on the savannah, because you go out on the savannah and you get things like elephants and rhinos and other large creatures that have just said, I'm going to get rid of the hair entirely, or for the most part, get rid of the thick hair. But the aquatic ape theory was the idea that, one of the things that's interesting is that we are actually really good swimmers. We are like the best swimmer of any primate. Of course, I don't know how often chimpanzees push each other to become better swimmers, but we are an extremely adaptable swimmer for a primate.
Not a lot of primate Olympians.
Yeah. Swimming comes very naturally to us. Another few months or something, we take, Justin's baby, we'll throw her into a pool.
No, that's definitely going to happen. We spend too much time in Florida for her to not have the infant drowning training. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the thing too, is we find out that, we're able to learn to swim at an early age. There's a few other adaptations and stuff that people say, that seems like we spent time in water. But when you look for other evidence to support, that's not there. But it is a neat idea that we may have spent part of our evolutionary history going in and around water, but none of those adaptations really have to be explained by that. But that being said, I think if we look at like Lucy, let's look up Lucy in seafood. That was, I think, Leakey who found seafood, found Lucy Abe.
I guess seashells is, let's see. Oh, Lucy primate. Here we go.
Yeah. Let's do a little search GPT.
Let's see.
By the way, I was rejected from the search GPT beta. They said, we've got enough. We're full, buddy. You're off the list. There ain't no list no more.
Wait,
well, just saying. The serial disrespect I get from this company. Both of my friends have the new voice mode. Still nothing. Just a desert out here. I want search GPT. Can't have search GPT. Yeah. It's just enough for me to just silently use their products every single day to make my life better. I'm not going to compliment them anymore until they give me things.
Well, if it makes you feel better, I think my advanced mode went away.
Oh, really?
Mine leaves and then comes back, and I have to repurchase Plus again and again. It's weirdly jank.
So I couldn't find anything about Lucy actually eating seafood, so that's a complete lie. Thank you for showing me weird things, not called accurate things. Orangutans have been observed using tools to catch fish, such as catfish in the wild. Baboons have been recorded eating fish, and there's no evidence that Lucy, the Ostriolophus afarensis, ate seafood. So, I always thought it'd be kind of cool if you wanted to do a story is the fact that we, for the most part, get along really well with a lot of your whales and your dolphins, and that although, you know, even whales will go eat seals and other smaller mammals or whatever, humans, whale attacks on humans are exceedingly rare. And you always think like, why? What is that? And it might be they can kind of, one, just look at us and see that, you know, we don't have a lot of fat, we're not really worth eating or whatever, but behavior could be these other things. And I always thought, like, it'd be neat if in somewhere in evolutionary history, we just, like, use them like dogs.
Well, I think we talked about on a previous Weird Things episode that I'd read an article indicating that the batch of orcas messing with the rudders of boats appears to be a fad among teenagers, basically.
Yes. Yeah. 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 That's it's here's the thing too, is that I see this in AI because you sit there and we use ChatGPT or use these systems and they're trained on tremendous amount of human data. So these algorithms are incredibly good at carrying on conversations. As you know, Brian, when you use advanced mode, it is.
Sorry. Reaction to this smugness.
Yeah, it is absolutely uncanny to the point that I find myself sometimes arguing with these systems, and it knows the right things and says the right things. Oh, and you know, I can argue with
that. That's the real Turing test. The real Turing test is Andrew getting so sucked into a conversation that he starts arguing and correcting the advanced.
It's
you have crossed a threshold
five times an hour.
it's a corollary of the Turing test called the well actually.
Are you sure? Can you double check? Because I was under the belief.
Well, I find myself because I'm using them in code environments and I'm like, I just told you not to use this thing, you know, but part of it is they've been trained on a lot of data of like, please don't do this. Like, okay. And so it's strangely, they've somewhat kind of been trained a bit to react to that, which is kind of the perverse thing. The point is,
I'll get to it after your point.
Yeah. I was just saying what I was getting to, it's when we look at whales, we look at other really intelligent creatures that we share our planet with. When we think about intelligence, we're very biased towards our own version of that. And we might even have found Neanderthals to be kind of dumb or distant or odd because maybe they didn't socialize like we did. Maybe they had a much higher fear of strangers like we did, you know? And there can be certain behaviors that we remark as intelligence, but there actually can be entirely different markers.
There was a an image of an exchange on the ChatGPT Reddit thread that, you know, the first thing was, hey, generate code that says this. It says, here's how you do it. Just go ahead and do it. And it's like, no, do it for me. And then I'll download it. It's like, I can't download that. I can't do that for you and download it. And it's like, yeah, you've done it a whole bunch of times. It's like, nope, can't do it. And the guy just responded, bro, period. And then it says, you know what? You're right. I can do it. Here you go.
Yeah, there's certain things that go into play where, because there's a lot of layers of training that go on top of these systems, because it used to be the early GPT-3 days was just basically the internet with an input and an output, you know, and see what it gets, to then the reinforcement learning, the human feedback, when the instruction following training. So it just got more and more used to that. And sometimes say, I can't do that because it was told to say that it can't do that. But you can say, hey, you sure? And it might be like, oh, wait, no, I can do that. They lied to me. Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite phrases from the new Nate Silver book, because he did a really good job of you know, giving metaphors for the ChatGPT environment. And he pointed out that, look, there is no one AI. Every single AI, like, you can't build an AI or a GPT without your company putting the thumb on the scale and deciding what you will and won't allow. So it's like, whatever flavors you're getting are all on purpose, per the company and what their comfort levels are.
Yeah. If it's not a base model, for sure.
And it's funny that you figure that, sentiment is probably a year old still too, you know, and you know, there's been so much advancement in terms of models on models on models, training other models, whether or not it's, you know, even disclosed. You have a lot of these smaller models that are being trained on synthetic data that, you know, we're eventually going to see traits of, you know, long after the original models were trained. It's moving so fast. It's crazy.
Want to do picks?
Yeah. I guess right. I'll go first. You know what? My pick is a recommendation from one Andrew Main. It is the novelization of Marvel Comics' Secret Invasion. It's much, much better than represented in anything from the MCU. Didn't really care for how it was handled in the MCU at all. But it's a straight up, I did the audiobook novelization, and it's just a book of the comic books, and it's great. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I recommended this to Brian and Justin because I've been, you know, looking for some light stuff to listen to before I go to sleep. And the Secret Invasion comic, unlike, you know, the TV show, the comic has, you know, all the Marvel MCU characters.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, hey, cool. If we were about to have the Earth invaded, it's what you call an Avengers level threat. And you know who you'd want?
The Avengers.
Oh, in the middle of this, and this also takes place in the middle of the Civil War saga. So you've got the Rebel Avengers. You've got Harry Osborn with
the Thunderbolt. The Thunderbolts.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's pretty cool, kind of just like, meanwhile, you know, in, you know, the secret Antarctic kingdom here, what's going on here? And meanwhile, here. And man, Tony Stark. Bit of a jerk.
I guess I won't spoil it, but there's a great scene where they offer a plausible explanation for why he's such a big jerk, which was really interesting.
Yeah.
You know, it really is. I hope that we are entering back into a period with the MCU where you can kind of get to like the real core. What you are mining for in Marvel Comics is just this unbridled imagination and excitement that like all these things are possible. All these people can run into each other. You can tell these very exciting, complex stories. And unfortunately, that works better when you have a lot of actors that are under manageable contracts than ones that are extraordinarily expensive. Although that being said, that doesn't really account for why Secret Invasion sucked, because it had maybe one of the best cast shows of the last year. If you just look top to bottom for any kind of miniseries, it's just got a murderer's row. I think it has like three or four different Oscar nominated actors or winners in it. And it still stank like a dead fish.
Yeah, we've talked about this a lot before, but you know, the challenge that Disney and Marvel's had is Disney is known for being, you know, very efficient and trying to cut their costs wherever they can, which one hand is helpful. The other hand, though, is that you can do it to the point that you make things substantially more expensive, where, you know, the Marvels had a $70 million
production budget
over budget. Yeah, it was over budget by 70.
Holy moly.
Yeah, which is, you know, an entire another feature film. And I think, too, what's probably happening, too, is that a lot of actors in the MCU find out that just because you're in a billion-dollar movie with a Marvel logo on it doesn't mean that you go off and you go do a solo movie. It'll be a billion-dollar movie. And so be curious to see what happens, you know, in the future and stuff and whatnot. I also think Disney's learned, Marvel's learned a lot, too, about if you can control your, because part of the problem too for many Marvel actors is it's the commitment. It's because it's like on one hand, like, oh, and you know, they budget for reshoots. It's cool. So what is my calendar going to look like if I say yes to your movie? Well, you know, like, oh,
yeah, they get those, those first position rights, which it's like, we'll tell you when you could do, when you can and can't do your other movies.
Yeah. And also for them, you know, for a lot of the actors, it means they have to get in shape, you know, the toll that takes on the body. You know, that's huge. It's a big kind of commitment. So we'll see what's going to happen as they sort of evolve. You know, Feige is a smart guy. Feige, I remember I got to see him speak once. Forgot which movie it was that he was in LA and he was there to do a talk. And they talked about why for superheroes, why he didn't cast like bodybuilders and stuff. And he'd said, you know, from experience, he said, we find out it's a lot easier to put muscles on an actor than to teach muscles how to act.
Yeah.
And I think that that's the thing that they might kind of go forward is to say like, yeah, you know, listen, if we can put you in a super suit with some padded muscles and stuff, will you come back and go do it?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. We talked about how much we love Deadpool and Wolverine, but one of the things that kind of came to me a few weeks afterward is that Feige very much used this movie as a reset for the MCU, and I think it was deliberate that they led, you know, the next Comic-Con with a big announcement of reshaping what the Avengers movie is going to be and announcing Doctor Doom and obviously bringing in Robert Downey Jr. But what they did with Deadpool and Wolverine was, you know, bringing a lot of these movies that Feige at his primordial was the script reviewer for Marvel for these movies that oftentimes, like Elektra, were imperfect. And he knew when they worked, he knew when they were good, like he did with Blade. He knew when they were misfiring, like they did with Daredevil and Elektra. And that was the kind of lesson that he knew. Well, when we start making, or when they eventually started making Marvel movies, this is what worked. This is what doesn't. This is what fans want. This is what fans respond to. This is what they don't. So for him to kind of reclaim those characters and say like, no, look, we're going to make a great, we're going to bring Blade back. We're going to bring Elektra back. We're going to have, you know, the Channing Tatum gambit that you never got to see in this movie. It just shows you like, all right, this is for fans. This is for people like to service the fan and that will grow. That was the lesson of the MCU from the very beginning. There was a quote that I read from some Reddit thing. I forget the movie. I think it might've been like Prince of Persia or something like that. But it was Bob Iger being asked whether or not he was going to move Prince of Persia because Iron Man was coming out. And his quote was, I'm not scared of Iron Man. Ah! So fast forward, you know, he's not scared of Iron Man, at least in cutting the gigantic check that he just paid Robert Downey Jr. to come back and play another role.
That's a great point, because in the way we tend to imagine things is we think of the whole MCU as being the Marvel Disney thing, but it predated Disney. Like, I just went back and watched the original Iron Man, by the way. It held up. I really enjoyed it. Started to watch the Hulk, Incredible Hulk movie.
And, the Ed Norton Hulk?
It's like, it's I remember seeing the theaters and it's fine. Like, the Ang Lee was just too weird and stuff. But I mean, like, I was watching the one in theaters. It's like, I want to make a Hulk movie, but I don't really like the Hulk. You know, like Hulk shows up like twice, you know? It's and then it's,
you know, that's, I forget if it was just me and you, Maine, that we're talking about, but like Jodorowsky's Dune, you know, is a movie that is kind of revered by people who like that director, and, you know, is not necessarily looked at as any kind of good Dune movie. And it's one of those things with pulp, you know, fiction.
Which one are you talking about? Which movie you're talking about?
Jodorowsky's Dune, the Polish.
The director. Unmade one that never got
The unmade one. Yeah. That was legendary, right? It was going to be made. But you don't suspect it was going to be very good, because he wants to tell a psychedelic story, right?
Yeah,
he wants to tell a story about tripping in the desert, and you're going to use the bones of this thing like Dune, which that happens all the time. You take short stories that have an interesting twist, you layer a bunch of new stuff on it, and you make a better story. The problem with a lot of these genre fiction projects like Marvel or Dune, or, you know, George R.R. Martin is apparently pissed off about how House of the Dragon has turned out. Like, there's a lot of intricate stuff that's happening. And, like, you don't need to layer a whole nother thing on top of it. Like, Hulk succeeds as a character because of things that are there in the text. Just honor the text and tell an interesting story around it. It doesn't need to be about another thing that you have in your head. And I think that's where, when the MCU has been at its best, it's been about, you know, telling these really, really rad stories and updating them, tweaking them, adapting them, but more in the way that Peter Jackson did for Lord of the Rings, and less in the way that you would just take a short story and say, well, this is really about my dad.
Yeah, that was what's frustrating about me for Foundation was and as a science fiction show, it's actually fine. You know, the Foundation 1 and 2, like, I actually once I had to realize, oh, they're going to throw away the things you liked about it. They're going to put in some ideas that aren't as good, but more interesting than most science fiction on TV. You know, and that was once I realized, okay, this is really. That it's, you know, like a certain person's adaptation of The Watchmen. Like, I don't think you read the same book I did.
Yeah.
But you don't have the same conversations with my friends I have about what it's about. But that being said, it ended up being its own thing. But God, I would love a Foundation adaptation.
Yeah. That's my pick. Foundation. Go read the Foundation books. And then imagine what a good movie would be where they adapted it. Because I will still say, of science fiction made from like 1900, you know, to 2000, the one untapped, unadapted, not done amazing villain comes from the adaptation stories. And to even mention them would ruin what's rad about it. But one day, maybe.
Yeah, it's my problem with Foundation, and again, I've enjoyed what it is that everything you needed to do to set up that thing, they didn't do.
Yeah.
Because they went for a different story. And, you know, Foundation to me is, it's very much the power behind power, how bureaucracies really work. And, you know, what happens when something completely unpredictable comes along, you know, and being in plain sight.
Yeah.
You know, what about you? The analogy I think about,
oh, sorry.
My pick is, no, that's all right. My pick is, I'm going to do Iron Man.
Yeah, dude, it does hold up outside of a couple of super dated references, like no MySpace or, you know, that kind of stuff. But when I went back, I watched
But it's a period piece, Brian.
Yeah, it is. Well, and that's what I was going to follow it up with, is there's something so refreshing. By the time you get to the end of the, 21 movie journey, you know, everything is all wizard powers. You know, it's nanoparticles, it's this, that. There's something beautiful about a car battery and the deeply grounded origin story of Iron Man and the slow teasing out of all the supernatural celestial elements that the MCU goes into. Like, that first movie is so grounded. I agree. It holds up.
Yeah, I would say that the weirdness kind of came in. I enjoyed Iron Man 3. I enjoyed a lot about it. But it was like when you're, and again, this is a world, by the time that world is around, we've got Thor and we've got Asgard, so I'm not going to be too nitpicky. But it's like, you know, he's in Miami and, you know, his wrist gauntlet sitting in a warehouse in Ohio, you know, is able to fly all the way there to him. It's fine. But then it's the idea that him being so resourceful and him being, you know, so imaginative.
Iron Man 3, watchable movie. There's some really fun stuff. I like the way that they handled the Mandarin. I think, weirdly, it's been one of the more enduring characters in this phase of the MCU. But it was kind of a make-work project for Shane Black. Shane Black was the only dude who would give Robert Downey Jr. a job. And, like, you know, in his own way, Shane Black paved the way for the MCU more than some of the directors of the original movie.
Gentlemen, it's been weird.